Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/Carlin and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/Carlin or text Carlin to 500-500 and get started today.
It's hardcore history. Addendum.
I've said before that one of the wonderful side benefits of a gig like this is the chance to speak to people whose work you really admire and talk to them about it. And in this case, I have a guest on the program today who is a source, somebody that we use in our work. And when we did Blueprint for Armageddon, he was sort of my go-to guy in terms of somebody that I knew could add a different dimension to the storytelling by having a letter or a document or a quote or something that was just, you know, so visceral or perfect or emotional, or that in one short little paragraph managed to capture such a poignant, you know, point that just sort of made the whole, you know, section of the piece. I mean, Peter Hart's work is finding emotional nuggets that just knock you over and then incorporating them into the story in a way where they not only have the most impact, but they manage to add a part of the story that often gets missed. If you're telling, for example, a story on the First World War, which is Peter Hart's specialty, it is so easy to get yourself locked into the giant troop movements and the big decisions made at headquarters and all this. Sometimes you can go the total opposite extreme, and it's easy to get caught up in the diary of this one soldier or this one nurse or something like that. But to be able to blend the two in a way that helps you understand, for example, how the decisions made at headquarters with all those high muckety-mucks thinking about things abstractly, how they, you know, influence and intersect with the lives of some poor guy mortally wounded in a shell hole writing his last letter back to his wife and family. It's an art. And I think Peter Hart does it as well or better, especially on the subject of the First World War, than anyone I've ever read. So you get to see me enjoying my, you know, byproduct, the best aspect of this gig, the chance to talk to people whose work you admire, people like Peter Hart, who is, amongst other things, an oral historian, by the way, at the British Imperial War Museum, which is every military history nut's dream gig. Love to go to work by a couple of giant 15-inch naval guns, which one of those, you know, they have several of these war museums, but the main one in London has the big naval guns outside. You know, just take a picture. Here's where I work, right? Eat your heart out. Anyway, one little note. Normally, we have an in-house phone system we use when we do interviews, but normally we only use that for North American interviews. When we're overseas calls, we've been using sort of an internet system, and this time it let us down with some pretty serious glitches at times, especially near the end of the interview. Not only my apologies to Peter Hart, but to you also. It's frustrating, and there was no way for us to fix it. So I am going to put a couple of, shall we call them end notes, after the interview, where I both quote something that we referenced in the show so that we include that, explain something Mr. Hart said at the end that the digital glitches did not make easy to understand, and also read a letter that we referenced in the story to something that Peter Hart uncovered for one of his books that we used in the Blueprint for Armageddon series, and reread that to just show you the man's ability to demonstrate the ripples of pain that something like this conflict, you know, created in that era in those societies and drop you right into the middle of it for a minute. So without further ado, the wonderful author and oral war historian, maybe a good way to put it, the great Peter Hart. So the first thing I want to know, because I'm just curious, as a person who is absolutely jealous of anyone who can find such a specialty to devote their lives to, how did it for you mostly become, because you've done other things, but mostly become something about the First World War? What grabbed your interest about this, and what is it that keeps you so interested in the subject?
I think it started when I was young, and there was a program called The Great War, which was on telly in the 1960s, and it was gloomy and miserable, and it seemed so awful that people suffered so much. And for me, that it's always been that dichotomy. It's a dichotomy between the people who suffered and what the generals did and why they did that, because you may or may not realize I quite support the approach of the generals. And it's the way that, you know, it's an entirely logical way of behaving, but it's terrible for those that are involved. And that has always informed, or I hope has informed, all the work I do. It's what it's all about for me.
Now, you've been doing it long enough so that you've been around to watch sort of how public perception over time on these events has changed. Because I remember, I was born in 1965, and I remember in the United States growing up as a kid, there was a sense about the First World War that it was like the Second World War, but a little less in terms of the good and evil. Still the good and evil. The Kaiser was evil man, but not quite to Hitler's standards. And then since I've grown up, that good-evil aspect to the First World War has seemed to be to fade over time quite a bit, at least here in the United States. Have you noticed, can you comment a little bit on the differences in the way, you know, Barbara Tuchman writes a book years ago that Jack Kennedy reads that's really particularly hard on the Germans. The stuff I read today has a very different tone. What have you noticed in the change of, if we were doing news, we would say the coverage over the last, say, four decades of the First World War?
I've noticed a fair amount of coverage. My perception has always been that in the end, if there were baddies, then it was the Germans, but that there were a lot of people doing things that were difficult or wrong. There were four or five major empires that were struggling together, trying to establish domination. A lot of them had agendas that we wouldn't particularly recognize as today as being pleasant, or, you know, the colonialism, things like that, their treatment of their colonies, the way they generally behaved, you know, through in everything. And for me, we have now an acceptance that whilst the Germans pushed the war, they partly did that because they were being pushed by the Russians and the French, who had their own agendas. And it's just become much more complicated. The thing is, it's not easy, is it? You know, that's the problem with history, that when you add nuance, things stop being good and evil, start becoming just much more complex.
Now, one of the things you do so fantastically, we try to do it here too. It's a great, if you can pull it off, it's a great way to do it. You pull it off all the time, where you're able to take the reader from the macro. You know, you'll have us in the boardroom, and you'll have quotes from assistants to the great, you know, grand strategists who are deciding how to use troops on the battlefield. And then all of a sudden you'll telescope down to some poor combatant who's injured mortally in some shell hole, who's writing a last letter to his wife and kids that he's going to strap to his body to find later. First of all, you know, explain to the listener a little bit how you go about finding these materials. It would seem to me to be one of the luxuries of working in a semi-modern era. I mean, the poor Roman historian has much less in the way of letters from combatants to go on, but you're able to emotionally mine this material out there. How do you find it? And if it's as powerful as it is on the sterile text page as I'm reading it, how much more powerful is it for you when you're holding the actual stained letter in your hands?
Well, that was in one of my books that I found a letter that was from a French soldier. That I used that. But I am extremely lucky that I have been, for the last 35 years, the oral historian at the Imperial War Museum. So I did a lot of the First World War interviews with veterans, and that provided me with a fantastic source, which the War Museums allowed me to use. And secondly, I have worked closely with the Department of Documents there, just opening the dusty old folders. They're all catalogued and preserved by the staff. But, you know, you open these, and you've no idea what you're going to find. And sometimes it can be utterly tedious, you know, just letter after letter, or boring, you know, no. And then suddenly you get something that's really visceral that tears you apart, that, you know, you just get letters that you realize these are the last letters. They, you know, you've been reading this bloke's life, and then suddenly it's not his letter, it's a letter from his commanding officer. And it, you know, it's amazing. And I just think I'm very lucky to work at the War Museum. From that, I then look through lots of other sources. I go to other museums, I go to other places. And of course, I look at personal experience books, mainly old ones, but like I use quite a few modern ones, or regimental histories often have it buried inside them, personal experience accounts. You know, the Americans I picked up a lot from the internet, where the PDFs of the books from the 1920s are online and you can consult them. It's fabulous. And that's where I get the material. Yes, it can be, you know, the actual real letters that I see at the museum can be really painful.
You know, obviously humans are humans at ground zero, but when you're reading, and you focus mostly on the British side of the experience, but you cover everything, do you notice any broad differences in, say, you're reading something from ground zero from a French soldier or some German soldier on the line versus some British or American soldier? Are there any differences in terms of the way that their national characteristics sort of come through in the material, or at ground zero when you're sitting in a trench with artillery falling all around you, are we broadly the same?
I very much go for broadly the same. I'm not a great believer in national characteristics anyway. It can help sometimes as a shorthand to explain certain things, but if you take it too literally, it goes into dark alleys. What I really think, though, is that underneath, human beings, when they're placed under real pressure, tend to respond in a similar sort of way. And for me, a French soldier, the accounts, you know, sometimes I have to translate, which can be difficult. I'm not great. A friend of mine translated the German ones for me because I don't, you know, speak or read German. And fundamentally, they're the same. They have slightly different ways of expressing themselves, but that's just cultural. But underneath, when the shells are falling, when their friends are killed, when they're given orders that could lead them to be killed, they're the same sort of people. They are us. They're just ordinary people.
You know, that's maybe one of the things that at least, I mean, I imagine touches many people once they start, you know, reading about the war, is these incidents where, you know, the comradeship, maybe the German soldiers would say, but we're the soldiers of multiple sides who, you know, more and more modern histories will talk about how prisoners would be killed sometimes and all the horrors of war. And yet at the same time, you know, the notions when these people end up having truces where they, you know, share Christmas decorations or play football, as you guys would call it, soccer, we would call it, or any of the many, many incidents like that, getting stuck in a shell hole with someone from the other side. In your latest book, there was a primary source quote where a British soldier had his arm really badly injured and goes marching to the back with a bunch of German prisoners who start doctoring his wounds. Do you notice, I mean, I don't see as much of that, and it might be part of the historiography or what have you, part of the myth-making, but when I read stuff in the Second World War, I find a lot less of that than in the First World War. Anything on the front of your mind that might account for the difference there, or am I just imagining that there is one?
I don't think you're imagining it, Don. That there is. There was more hatred in the Second World War, I think, and we all... It's only our opinions from the things we've read, but I've interviewed an awful lot of Second World War soldiers than First World War soldiers, and there is more hatred there because of the nature of the regime they're fighting. Now the communist regime in Russia was pretty rough as well, but there was a hatred of the Nazis. But very rarely in any war, there are not many soldiers that respond with murder and torture and the rest of it. Most of them, in my experience, maintain a lid on their emotions, but there are a few who do respond with acts of just murder, or panic. You know, often it's panic that triggers the murder. The First World War, that you mentioned it first up, comradeship is the thing that binds the armies together. But most of all, it binds you to your fellow soldiers. That's what helps you. That's what lets you go over the top. It's not king and country or president. It's not religion. What in the end when it all comes down to it, it's mostly the blokes you're with, your mates, the men who you went through training with, who faced death with you. That's what helps you to get through it.
You know, you mentioned something going over the top a minute ago, such an iconic way of differentiating the, at least Western Front experience of this war from all the others. And, you know, it occurs to me that because of sort of the nature of technology and the way things have gone, I don't think you're ever going to get the same experience that those First World War soldiers went through ever again. I mean, I don't think you're ever going to have hundreds and hundreds or thousands of guns peppering a small space of territory anymore. You don't need to because of the accuracy. You're never going to mix them with gas the way you did. I mean, if you think, as I do, that would have been, you know, equal to the worst place a soldier could have ever been, right? Front of the line, about to go over the top, Western Front. I don't think you're ever going to get that experience again. You're never going to have human beings watch. I forgot the author who had said one of the soldiers described watching a forest disappear in front of his eyes due to artillery. I mean, that's a human experience that I don't think any human being is going to ever see again. In the beginning of the Second World War, Churchill's History of the War, he talked about what was in store in 1919, if the war hadn't ended in 1918, the various, you know, horrible concoctions that the Allies had put together.
Absolutely.
Your latest book, The Last Battle, is from that era. Can you talk a little bit about what 1919 on the front might have looked like?
The British had the Germans had a blue cross gas that didn't work properly, a mixture of a pernicious gas and a sort of particles. And the particles made you vomit, so you had to take your gas mask off, and then the gas, you know, the poisonous gas got you. Now, the German version didn't work properly, but the British had worked out, and their allies, by the way, had worked out how to do it, and they fully intended to poison most of the German army in 1919. It is a vicious war, and the practices, in a way, that was just one step forward. You know, because we've sort of moved on. Then it was mass barrages. Now, there's no need for mass barrages now. And although we did revert to it after El Alamein, for instance, has one. They have them in 1944 in Europe. But it's replaced by mass bombing, isn't it? And then, of course, there's a nuclear method. And then it's accuracy. And so technology moves on. But the killing can still be on a mass scale. For instance, in the Iraq War, there was mass killing, the Gulf War, mass killing and it needs to be remembered. What happens is the mass killing tends not to be on our side anymore. So that's pretty well how I feel about it.
Well, it is interesting, too, because when we were talking about the First World War in the series that we did on it, you know, you almost want to overwhelm the listener with both the casualty statistics and then the amounts. I mean, the sheer numbers of things like shells. I mean, the numbers overwhelm you. A lot of Americans, for example, they like to tell jokes about the French and surrendering in the Second World War. And so you like to point out, hey, wait a minute. You know, when did our side ever take 27,000 dead in a single day? You know,
Absolutely.
Those kind of numbers are so overwhelming that in the United States, you know, there's not a lot of memorials to the First World War and all this, but you go to Europe and they are everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the lasting effect? I mean, the feeling of connection to the First World War never died down in Europe, did it?
Not really. Well, for the French and Germans, it was monstrously painful business. I mean, their casualties are much higher than the British. The French in particular, you're right, that's in August 1914, the French lost 27,000 dead in a single day. Now, the British whinge on about suffering, I think, 600 dead at Mons. It's a different scale. And the French then fought almost on their own for 2 or 3 years. People say the Americans took a long time to get into the war, you know, from April 1917 to June, July 1917 to 1918. So a bit over a year. But the British took from August 1914 to the Somme, July on the Somme, before we were properly involved. People often forget when they're throwing stones at other countries, they forget, like we sometimes do at the Americans, or the Americans do at the French, or the British do at the French. When you look at your own side, we often have the same sort of problems or the same faults. And I find that it's one of those interesting things. the American losses were dreadful in the First World War. They suffered a very high rate of losses from when they fully joined the battle. The battle in the Argonne, the Meuse-Argonne region, is murderous. It's as murderous as any other battle in the First World War. And considering that they only really fought full pelt for 3 months, the American casualties are worth remembering. But for one reason or another, possibly because they disengaged from Europe a bit in the interwar years, the Americans have never really remembered it in the same way as we do.
Yes, I always try to imagine if the U.S. had fought for 2 years at those kind of casualty rates. We'd have a few more war memorials around here.
You certainly would.
You know, I think about context. You know, if history teaches anything, it helps us understand how things get to where they are. And in this country, once again, you know, they'll try to use in political discussions the lessons of history, right? We know from the 1938 appeasement stuff that you can't do this or that or the other thing, you know, the classic misuse of the lessons of history. But I always try to, and I'm going to ask you for your opinion on this because you've read a lot of stuff. The generation that gets accused of really doing anything they could to avoid another world war are the ones that lived through it as younger people. How did that scar the leadership on you know, both sides, really, in the Second World War as they sort of maneuvered, jockeyed, threatened, tried to avoid via compromise a repetition of the worst thing any of them had ever lived through?
Oh, I think there's some truth in that. I'm not an expert on the interwar years, but certainly that there was peace movements in Britain and the French were pretty broken by their awful experiences. You know, Pétain is the one that gets most of the blame for what happened, but he was responding to a popular element within the country that they just were not willing to suffer it all again. I have so much sympathy for them. The Germans, of course, also, but you just have less sympathy for them somehow. The British, you know, it took a while for us to get properly into the war. I mean, even in the Second World War, the phony war, and then, you know, people were trying to get that. There was an appeasement movement in Britain right until Churchill took over. And Churchill, for all his faults, was the one that finally pinned the British into opposing Nazi Germany in the long term, because there were elements in British society that were perfectly happy to do a deal with Hitler. It's a complex period, which I am not an expert on at all.
Your latest book called The Last Battle focuses on, you know, from a military history standpoint, I think one of the most fascinating periods in the First World War, but it seems to get lost in the Verduns and the Sommes and the Passchendaeles and all that. Talk a little bit about that era where we go away from the iconic Western Front of a stalemate on the front to open movement again and something that looks like a, you know, prototype for 1939 warfare.
It certainly is. Everything changes with it's the Allies come up with the all-arms battle, which is basically binding all the different weapons, the artillery, the gas, the mass machine gun fire, the tanks, the aeroplanes, the light machine guns, the mortars, everything together, working together with to overwhelm anything the Germans could do, to break through. But also, it's the different, not just attacking on one place like at the Somme or Pasha, but to attack four attacks, four battles, 4 days. The Americans go first, then the British and the Canadians, then the French, the Belgians and the British, and then finally the British again and the French. Four battles, 4 days. Pushing the Germans. Now, the reason it's missed out, and normally books finish round about the 8th of August, my own book on 1918, A Very British Victory, which was a bit of a joke title, I have to admit. I don't know why I did that. I have got a sense of humor, which does come out at times, possibly naughtily. And the point was that your publisher, they say, right, we've had enough of them going over the top now. And that's why you tend to miss out. Even that book by me, you know, misses out the last 6 weeks of the war. And I wanted to put that right with this because there are so many enormous battles. Open warfare comes, and open warfare is worse. The casualty figures get higher. much higher, because you're in the open. If something goes wrong, you know, Haig orders the British to go forward, to push through in a very modern fashion, push through, ignore isolated pockets of resistance, they'll be dealt with. But if you're an infantry soldier and you go past an isolated pocket of resistance, you'll get killed. And your mates will as well, because they'll fire into your flanks as you go by. So it's efficient militarily, but it leads to huge casualties. It's a painful time for the British and for the Americans, who are learning at the same time. And anyone who insults the American, the courage of the American troops in the Argonne-Meuse battles is mad, because if you insult them, you're insulting the British on the Somme, and you're insulting the French in 1914. You're insulting basically armies that don't know what's going to happen to them. They haven't had chance to learn. And that, I think, you don't learn this until you get right into the end of the war, because the Americans don't really get into the war until September, about September the 26th. That's when their war really starts, when they attack, you know, the Argonne Forest. What a place. You know, I've been there. It's murder.
You know, you mentioned earlier, and you just sort of opened the door to it again. One of the points of views on this subject that you're kind of known for, you know, I'd put you, and I guess you would put yourself, in the camp of those who look at, for example, the performance of the generals, which, of course, famously some compare to, you know, butchery, to, if I could, I could sum it up, maybe doing pretty well, considering what a natural learning curve on a big technological revolution in military affairs like this one might be. Is that fair to say that you think that they've done a pretty good job, all things considered?
Spot on, particularly some of the more advanced French and British generals. And I stand by Haig, and I know it makes me unpopular in some places. The thing about Haig was don't think of him as a general, think of him as a chief executive of a massive American corporation, someone who provides direction, someone who brings things together, someone who enables and makes things happen. If you think of him that way, you're getting a much better idea of what he was. He was the commander-in-chief of five armies. There is no such thing in the Second World War. I mean, you know, there was people who were supreme commanders, but they had people to deal with politicians. They had people to deal with their allies. That doesn't happen in the First World War. It's just Haig who has to deal with all of them. And that's how it works. And they did come up. It's not Haig comes up with it, but he enables the system which allows the all-arms battle to function. And can I just – it's not a learning curve. What it is two Big Dippers side by side. And one's the Allies, or the British, if you were to look at it narrowly, British or Americans. And then the other side is the Germans. And for every new attacking method you bring in, the Germans bring in a defensive method. So it's not a curve. You go up and you go down. And something that works on Tuesday might not work next Thursday, because the Germans will have changed their tactics. That's an analogy, not an exact time frame, obviously. But what I mean is it's constantly changing. So in 1915, one trench line, perhaps one and a half. Then later in that year, there's three trench lines. By the year afterwards, there's three trench systems and then redoubts. Soon after that, you start to get the pillboxes, the underground blockhouses where the troops can be kept safe. You get different machine gun tactics. So the Germans are constantly changing. Now, we change as well. British bring in tanks. Are they great? Not for first, but they're part of it. Different tactics. Different infantry tactics. So both sides are changing. And hence, if you think of two Big Dippers, I think you call them something else in America, but, you know, the little railway lines going up and down hills and running side by side. And you find out who's going to win a battle by where you are in relation to the other side. Hence, on the Somme, first day of the Somme, 1916, we're very low down there. The Germans have got great trench systems, great weapons of defense, and we're inexperienced. We don't know what we're doing. But all told, by the end of the war, we really have learned, and we're at a very high ebb. We're looking down on the Germans, but it is a complex system that Gordon Corrigan, a British historian, once said it wasn't the generals that killed our boys; it was the Germans. And it's the same for your American lads. It's the Germans that did it, and when we try and blame just our generals or just our senior officers or blame our allies, You're not understanding what's happening. We're fighting a very complex war against the best army in the world, one of the biggest army in the world, the Germans.
You wrote in your book that modern warfare was just so damn complicated at every level. So let's talk about that for a minute, because it seems to me, and obviously there were earlier wars where these changes happened, but so slowly that they may not have been important. It seems to me that the First World War is the first one where we get that very modern sort of sense where technology is changing so quickly that it's not that you're going to have to learn the lessons of this war and adapt for the next war. You're going to have to learn the lessons of today's air combat, for example, so that in 6 months you have the newest discovery, or the other side is going to shoot your people out of the air. Now, in the Second World War, you saw this dynamic going on all the time. What's the latest tank? What's the latest version of the airplane? But in the First World War, it seems like that's the first time that needing to learn on the fly and adapt during the conflict becomes, well, a war-winning or a war-losing potentially thing.
Absolutely. And it's so quick. I mean, the aircraft that took before the Battle of the Somme, the aircraft that took that won control of the air over the Somme were British. And that there were things like the DH-2, the FE-2B, the Sop with 1.5 strutter. By God, there were names to conjure with them.
Camels.
that's 17. That's later. But they took control. They were outclassed totally by the Albatross just 3 months later. 3 months. Now, people like me still think that the Hawker Harrier is a decent aircraft. That's 1950s technology that flew in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and has been outdated now for the best part of 10 years. Then it was months, just months, and you could be flying an aircraft that was great, and now it's useless. In fact, it's a death trap when you meet something better. And I find, and I think that there is a warfare is a catalyst for change. You get generals or people like generals who define a need. And then you get scientists who do the thinking, who work out the theory of how to meet that need. And then you have, you have the practical men. Now, they're engineers, they're practical soldiers, and they work out how to actually do it. You know, how to fix that camera to an aeroplane. You know, how to, you know, somebody else works out the focal lengths and everything else, but, you know, someone has to work it out. You get the theory of a synchronization machine so you can shoot through the propeller or not through the propeller, if you see what I mean. The theory is very well and good, but you need practical men to make it work. And warfare drives along technological change, a bit like in the 60s, if I might suggest, although it's not my subject, a bit like the space race did the same. You know, driving along technological change because someone's defined a very real need.
Well, and then to bow tie this with what we just talked about, and then somebody from the military hierarchy has to figure out how it all fits together operationally. And if you're the CEO, like you said, and a guy like Douglas Haig, you have to remember that it's a guy who has to factor in all this, what we would call today high-tech stuff, who's a cavalry officer born in the mid-19th century.
Yep, he was. But he learned. He was known as the educated soldier. He was an enthusiast. I mean, you read, you can find a quote for everything if you look through the thing. So you'll find, you know. But he was an enthusiast for machine guns. In fact, if Haig has a problem, he's often too keen on new weapons. He sometimes he doesn't appreciate that you have to bed them in. There's no point building 300 tanks and sending them forward if you don't know how to drive them, which we didn't in 1916. It's only 1917 we knew how they worked, how to use them in action, how to fit them in into the all-arms battle. What's going on is very like, it may be a British term or it may be an American term that we now use, but Haig would not have recognized this term, but best practice. You know what I mean? All the time, the British Army is engaging in something called best practice. They wouldn't know what that meant, but they look at a battle, what worked, what didn't. Best practice, they then disseminate in a series of pamphlets called the SS, unfortunately, with our perspective, but SS pamphlets. And those pamphlets, how to do this, how to use a tank in battle, how to use Lewis machine guns, how to make an attack, how to do this, how to do that. And this is just you know, this is just the stuff of modern warfare. And it takes staff officers, it takes generals, and it takes someone like Haig at the top to coordinate it. He's not a genius. He's not Napoleon. He's probably not even Wellington. But what he is a driven individual whose mind, for one reason or another, it's a perfect staff officer mind, a combination of detail, drive, and the guts to set a direction, you know, a direction which is painful to many of the men who served for him.
When you're reading the histories, too, I mean, it's so funny because, and you know, Churchill's a perfect example of someone who will push this, but you mentioned it with Haig, too, where you can see that the best way to use this new technology is to sort of surprise the other side with it and benefit from the shock value. But as you just pointed out, the problem is that you don't know how to use it until you've used it a few times. And then by then, of course, the Germans have started responding with countermeasures and whatnot. I mean, remember, was it Churchill talked about using the tanks when they first appeared in little pinpricks as opposed to some giant battle where 1,000 of them overwhelmed the front. But as you pointed out, if that was the first time you ever really employed them, would it have been effective at all?
I'd like to take, yes, that's a great example, because the 15th of September is the first tank attack. Three quarters of them broke. I'm rubbish at statistics. I'm not that kind of historian. Let's just take the broad brush. Three quarters of them, or two thirds of them, broke down and never got to the front. They'd left gaps in the barrage, the creeping barrage, which run forward in front of the infantry for the tanks. When they weren't there, the infantry didn't have any artillery support in front of them. They got lost. They had at the back wheels, because they thought they needed wheels at the back to steer them. They had no idea how to communicate between themselves and the infantry. When they go into action, to be absolutely honest, there are several historians, cynical historians, who think the tanks probably killed more British troops than German troops that day. Now, that is more what we call an outlier. You know, it's more just a point rather than a serious remark. But the point is, nobody had the slightest how to use the tanks in action. And we didn't have until Cambrai, you know, which is 1917, a year and a couple of months later. If we'd sent 1,000 tanks as they were on the 15th of September 1916 over the top, it would have been a disaster. Sorry.
No, that's okay. And we're getting some glitches on this end, which is not wonderful. So talk to me a little bit, if you could, about the difference that 4 years has made by the time this book that you've put out now, The Last Battle, is focusing on this. The governments of all these countries are fundamentally transformed. I mean, Russia, Imperial Russia's gone by this time. Austria-Hungary is shattered and looking for a way out of the war behind the scenes. You know, France has endured some serious troop morale problems in the not too distant past. And, you know, that's traditionally like the finest army in the world. And Britain has gone from the greatest creditor nation to one that is transferring their debt to New York now. What's the difference between the armies of 1914 and the governments that support them versus these armies of early 1918 and the governments that support and direct them?
Well, the 1914 armies would have been recognizable by Napoleon. The tactics, the way they were used, would have been recognizable from Napoleon from 100 years before. Yes, they got modern weapons, but they had no idea how to use them. The governments were old-fashioned governments. I mean, I know Britain best, but so I'll use them as an example. Lloyd George is very, very different from Asquith, who led the government. Asquith is not particularly competent. He's a polite old gentleman, drinks far too much, squiffy Asquith. Lloyd George has many, many faults. In fact, I'd need a few more many's to really encompass his many faults. But he is driven. And you don't have to hate Lloyd George just because you like Haig. They were chalk and cheese, but they both did their bit. Lloyd George was a classic war leader. He provided civilian direction. His idea of what to do with soldiers was madness, and he did not help the direction of the war on a strategic level. But on a sort of global level, he provided the drive. But Britain was running out of money. It was running out of resources. It was running out of troops. and it was running out of time. The war had to be finished in 18, and that's one thing that Haig realized. He was desperate to finish the war, not to give the Germans another, you know, chance to provide, to dig another set of trench lines, shortened perhaps, say, from Meuse. That's what they really, Haig and Foch both feared that. They had to get them the war finished. France had a revolution. We know there wasn't a revolution in France. We know there wasn't one in Britain, but there could have been, and people were very aware of that.
So those governments that would have made it into 1919 if the war were continuing might have had problems on the Allied side too, not just the Central Powers.
Oh, absolutely. War weariness. I mean, it's just, you know, it was an incredible story. There was no money. There's no men. Everything's depressed. It's just, you know, an awful thing to be involved in. And countries were struggling. And we needed Lloyd George to provide the leadership at the center and the determination to fight on to make sure that they would be beaten. I mean, it's so easy just to give up, to just say, well, we'll come to some compromise. But leaders like Lloyd George were not. Accept that.
I think that's everything. I mean, is there something about the new book that I didn't ask you about that is worth pointing out? I mean, I'm with you. I find it not just fascinating, but it's a little like discovering that a band and you thought you'd heard every song from them had a whole bunch of songs you didn't know about, and they're bigger and more interesting than you ever knew. Other than not being able to pronounce all of the battlefields in that wonderful last push in France, what about that last book have we not talked about that you think is especially compelling?
I'll tell you what, the thing for me is it's an emotional response, which I think you'll appreciate. It's just it's the essence of the book. If you've been fighting for 4 years, say you're a soldier in those trenches, you've been fighting for 4 years, and just as you start to think it's coming to an end, it's coming to an end, and then you have to go forward. You have to go into the attack. And not everybody do what you recognize from Second World War. It's called shell hole dropping. You can't all drop out. You know, you can't all fall back, keep behind. You just have to keep going with your mates. And the temptation to shirk in those final attacks in the final days must have been enormous. But somehow most found from somewhere the inner resolve, which people like me just can't really grasp or understand because it's beyond our experience, to finish the job. And you know, it was the worst of all for that. And I'm not just saying this because you're American. The worst of all was Pershing forced the final attacks on the night of the 10th, 11th, and even the morning of the 11th. And you know, the Americans had nearly 3,000 casualties. I'm rubbish on that final 24 hours. And just imagine what was going through their heads when they were told. I mean, the Marines that were told they had to cross the Meuse, you know, 100-foot wide river with Germans with machine guns on the other side, and just, I mean, what went through their heads? And that's the last thing I'd like to say about it. Just put yourself there and think about it.
That's why I like your book so much, because you do such a great job of giving me the chance to do that. Listen, we'll try to sell you a few books this time. I hope you'll come on the next time you have one, and I hope you'll write a bunch more.
Thank you very much. I'd love to. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
I've had a great time, too. Like I said, meeting heroes. Take care, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Ta-ra.
So again, my apologies for the digital glitches there. I will try to figure out a better method. I do want to encourage you, if you are a fan or interested in the First World War, to get Mr. Hart's books. The Great War is absolutely a classic. His one on the Naval Battle of Jutland in 1916 follows the same pattern with his context punctuated by oral historian quotes. It works so well. He wrote one on Passchendaele, which is, you know, as you know, probably awful, muddy, horrible, bloody, symbolic of the whole war at that stage. And then the new book, of course, The Last Battle, which focuses on the less well-known but murderous time period in the war, the phase of the First World War where everyone got out of the trenches and started moving again and began to take the kind of casualties that reminded them why they first dug into the ground in the first place. Now, as an addendum, A couple of things worth noting. First of all, at the very end of the conversation with Mr. Hart, he was talking about Pershing, and he was saying things like, you know, on the 10th, even on the 11th, you know, he was launching these offensives. Just a little explanation. The 10th and the 11th are the November 10th and November 11th, 1918, the day before and the day of the end of the war. The armistice taking effect. Everybody knew that, you know, at this hour, on this day, we're going to stop shooting. So everybody knew, okay, the war ends tomorrow or the war ends today. So how much does it bother you as a soldier in the trenches, well, maybe not even in the trenches at that point, leaning up against a broken down old French brick house in a ruined French building behind a tank as you're prepared to move forward to find out that your general wants to launch an offensive that's going to cost a lot of your lives in the last 24 hours of the war or something? So that's what he was talking about. You might think in your head of reasons why a general might want to do something like that and play with your own motivations for a minute. Now, the other thing I wanted to quote was we had mentioned that in the beginning of his famous series on the Second World War, you can't even call it a history. You should call it almost like a personal account from a participant. But Churchill's History of the Second World War has a wonderful start to it where he kind of talks about, he sort of picks up at the end of the First World War, which when you think about it is not a bad way to write the histories. And he talks about, you know, the war ending when it did and what was going to happen if it didn't. Right? What the plan was for 1919, and of course the war ends in 1918, right? But Churchill says if 1919 happened, you know, it was going to unleash terrors unlike, you know, any the world had ever seen. Churchill writes, quote, "But all that happened in the 4 years of the Great War was only a prelude to what was preparing for the fifth year. The campaign of the year 1919 would have witnessed an immense accession to the powers of destruction. Had the Germans retained the morale to make good their retreat to the Rhine, they would have been assaulted in the summer of 1919 with forces and by methods incomparably more prodigious than any yet employed. Thousands of airplanes would have shattered their cities. Scores of thousands of cannon would have blasted their front. Arrangements were being made to carry simultaneously 250,000 men, together with all their requirements, continuously forward across country in mechanical vehicles, moving 10 or 15 miles each day. Poison gases of incredible malignity, against which only a secret mask, which the Germans could not obtain in time, was proof, would have stifled all resistance and paralyzed all life on the hostile front subjected to attack. No doubt the Germans, too, had their plans, but the hour of wrath had passed. The signal of relief was given, and the horrors of 1919 remain buried in the archives of the great antagonists." End quote. And it's worth pointing out that even with the terrible and horrible destruction of the Second World War, there were some of the horrors of the First that were not revisited, which seems counterintuitive to human history, doesn't it? This idea that in total war, human beings would use every single weapon at their disposal, you know, to fend off total destruction. Yet those leaders in the Second World War who themselves were younger people who fought in the First and who experienced that somehow managed to not use poison gas again on a wide scale, for example. I don't know what conclusions you can draw from that, but it's an interesting variable to consider, isn't it? Finally, we had mentioned a note specifically that had stuck in my mind, and it obviously stuck in Peter Hart's mind too, from a soldier that was writing his, turns out to be last note home to his family. And it exemplifies the way Hart tends to work, where he will write a piece that sets up this emotional exclamation point and then deliver it to you. And it just stayed, we used it in Blueprint for Armageddon because it is so emotionally powerful. So here's what Hart writes. He's talking about this battle at the Somme, which he referenced in the interview, that terrible British day where they figured out, oh my gosh, you know, this isn't working the way we thought. And meanwhile, we're trying to figure it out in the open under machine gun fire behind a lot of barbed wire. And he says that the soldiers about to go on this attack would write these letters home to their families. And here's what he says, and then he quotes the powerful letter. He says, and this is from his book, The Great War, by the way, quote, "The final reports from the front," meaning of the Somme battle, "that filtered back to the British High Command were generally positive in tone. Overall, the visual impression of the barrage proved far more devastating than the truth on the ground. British progress had been more than discounted by German improvements in their defenses. But that was not known at the time on the British side of the wire. In any case, they had no choice. The offensive had to go ahead as the future of the alliance with France depended on it. In the last few hours, as Haig's men prepared for the ordeal, many wrote their sad last letters home. One was so beautifully expressed that it exemplifies the feelings of men trapped and tormented by the conflicting calls of country and family." Now he's quoting an original letter. Quote, "I must not allow myself to dwell on the personal. There's no room for it here. Also, it is demoralizing. But I do not want to die. Not that I mind for myself. If it be that I am to go, I am ready. But the thought that I may never see you or our darling baby again turns my bowels to water. I cannot think of it with even the semblance of equanimity. My one consolation is the happiness that has been ours. Also, my conscience is clear that I've always tried to make life a joy to you. I know at least that if I go, you will not want. That is something. But it is the thought that we may be cut off from one another which is so terrible, and that our babe may grow up without my knowing her, and without her knowing me. It is difficult to face, and I know your life without me would be a dull blank, yet you must never let it become wholly so. For to you will be left the greatest charge in all the world, the upbringing of our baby. God bless that child. She's the hope of life to me. My darling, au revoir. It may be that you will only have to read these lines as one of passing interest. On the other hand, they may well be my last message to you. If they are, know through all your life that I've loved you and baby with all my heart and soul, that you two sweet things were just all the world to me. I pray God that I may do my duty, for I know, whatever that may entail, you would not have it otherwise." End quote. Captain Charles May, 22nd Manchester Regiment. And then Peter Hart writes, quote, "Charles May, the loving husband of Bessie May and the father to his baby Pauline, would indeed be killed the next day. He's buried in the Danzig Allied British Cemetery. Small-scale tragedies," he writes, "litter the history of war. Sad reminders that the necessities of war ruin the lives of millions." End quote. That, ladies and gentlemen, is an art form. My thanks to Peter Hart for talking with us today. And listen, down the road, if we're lucky, we'll get to do it again. We've been telling you about Audible for years, obviously audiobooks and a whole lot more. If you haven't discovered the joys of audiobooks, there's elements to it that I think are going to develop that I already find fascinating. Take the element of whose voice it is reading to you. I mean, it's something you don't consider when you think about getting a book, is it? I mean, who's the narrator? I mean, I imagine one day you're going to be able to customize this with some sort of button, you know, with your favorite movie star. I want Michael Caine narrating today's book, and, you know, it'll all come out that way. But I was looking for recommendations for today's particular little discussion, and Peter Hart, who we just talked to, has a couple of books on Audible, but they're narrated by different people. And so I'm sampling them going, okay, do I want Peter Hart's book on the Psalm in this voice, or do I want Peter Hart's other book on the Psalm in this other voice? And it's interesting because it's an element you don't think about. There's a performance aspect to it. It's one of the things to like about audiobooks is you get to kind of, you know, have different people read to you in different voices, decide what you like. And like I said, someday I imagine this will be quite customizable. Audio books, of course, been around a long time. So has Audible. We've been telling you about them for years. They've been supporting us. And we've watched as they have, you know, sort of rolled out more and more features to what they do. I mean, one of the things we've talked about that's great about Audible, you know, you sign up to Audible, you get points, you get a book that's free every month. I mean, it's one of those membership type services, but there's things that they just do right. I mean, they roll over, you know, your points kind of. So if you don't get a book this month, well, those points accrue so that, you know, you have more next month. You own the books, which I love. It is so weird to me to purchase something and then realize, wait a minute, if you read the fine print, you don't actually own this. You own these books. If I'm going to buy something like this, I want to own it. I need a big selection, too, and Audible's got one. They carry titles in business, the classics, fiction, history, romance, mystery, thrillers, sci-fi, fantasy, self-development, kids and young. I mean, you know, like a bookstore, right? When I was younger, if you liked audiobooks, you got to go to the library and see what they had available on cassette tapes. Now, when a new book comes out and hits the, you know, bookstores, digital and, you know, brick and mortar, Audible usually has it too. That's a sign of the popularity of these things. And why not? It allows you to read a good book, to motivate yourself, educate yourself, entertain yourself, make yourself more successful and inspired while you're doing some other chore that does not require your full attention. You got to mow the lawn. Well, maybe you can, you know, get one of those classic books read at the same time. Got to iron some sheets. Well, why can't you be enjoying a romance novel at the same time? You get where I'm coming with this. Busy people are consuming books at rates that, well, when you consider how busy they are, they shouldn't be able to find the time to do that. Audiobooks fill a void, and Audible's the best place to get them. And if you sign up today, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/Carlin and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. You can download a title, start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/Carlin or text Carlin to 500-500 and get started today. If you don't know what to get, I recommend Peter Hart's two books on the Psalm. The newer one probably has more updated information. The official title of that is The Psalm, The Darkest Hour on the Western Front. But he's got an earlier book on the Psalm, also on Audible, narrated by an English gentleman. I believe his name is pronounced Tim Pigott Smith. And to me, it sounds more like Peter Hart's actually reading me the book. So the newer book probably has the newer information, but if you really want to have somebody reading to you that sounds more like the author, get the earlier book. The good news is they're both available on Audible, and if you can't decide, feel free to buy them both.
Sure, the older hardcore history shows can be a bit traumatic, with titles like Death Throes of the Republic, Judgment at Nineveh, and Addicted to Bondage. We just consider that truth in advertising. No pain, no gain is our motto. Pick up the entire catalog from dancarlin.com.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter. The address is @HardcoreHistory.